This week in Retronauts, it is the 90s, and there is time for Sega. Guys, hi everyone, welcome to another sparkling episode of Retronauts, Retronauts East. I am Jeremy Parrish, and with me this time, no surprises here, it is
Ben Edwards
and
Ben Elton.
And we are, well, I was going to say wrapping up our Sega Arcade History series, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Nope.
I sat down to make a list of all the games Sega released in the 90s. I thought, oh, we can, you know, their output slowed down. We can hit this all in one go. But then in putting the notes together, I realized, just based on how Retronauts East usually goes, it ain't going to happen. I mean, I had a salad at lunch, and I thought, I can eat this all at once. But then I got halfway through and realized, I'm done. I'm going to have to go with another session. So it's just like the podcast. It's the Retronauts East salad.
And we're all eating that salad right now while you speak.
We are not. That's weird.
No.
That's really strange. No. So we're not eating salads, but we are going to talk about Sega. So in our previous episodes, we talked about Sega's, let's see, their arcade history up through 1985. Then the games of 86 and 87, I want to say, which was, there was a lot happening those 2 years. And then most recently, 88, 89, and 90. So that takes us up to the 90s, because remember, technically a decade doesn't begin until January 1st of the year ending in one.
Oh, you.
Oh, me. But it's true. So we're sticklers for semantics here. Right, Benj?
That's right.
That's right.
You know it.
We sure are.
Staying out of staying out of that one and the Metroidvania one.
That's me blinking.
Yeah, so here we are cruising into the 90s, talking about Sega, and you know, I didn't think I knew that many Sega arcade games from the 90s, but my God, there's so many of them, and they're so monumental. This is like a decade in which Sega was basically saying, hey, everyone, let's change video games, and we'll lead the way. And, yeah, I don't know. Like, if you just look at the console history of Sega, you're like, okay, yeah, they made some good stuff. But if you look at the arcade history of Sega, especially in the 90s, it's like, how is this company not currently ruling the industry? The answer is a lot of really bad decisions along the way. But divorced of those bad decisions, you have some amazing games. And we're going to talk about them in the next 80, 90 minutes of podcasting. So put on your clean pants. You're going to need them. It's going to be a crazy, sloppy ride. I don't know what that means.
No, cut that out, please.
All right. So we begin in 1991. I don't know the exact release dates of any of these games, just the year. So this is all kind of out of order. I basically just went down the list at killer list of video games and said, these games are interesting and important, so we're going to talk about them. So there's not really much of a chronology here, and it's okay. We're just talking about the 90s as a big old lump. Remember the 90s? Mm-hmm. They were great. And I feel like they were kind of a homogenous slab. Like once you got past the hangover of the 80s, everything was just kind of extreme, and it was that way all the way up until, like, I don't know, September 11th, 2001.
Yep.
Something like that.
Something like that. So we have the decade preserved in an acetate slab, and we're going to look at it that way.
Yeah.
So let's begin by talking about Spider-Man.
So this one did not define a genre, even though it was maybe trying, but...
Yes, this is weird. This is an example of 90s Sega taking an established genre and saying, let's put a spin on it. And there are some interesting kind of collisions between ideas here, but it does not seem like that good a game.
No, it's so they took two genres in one is sort of the thing here. So it's a brawler sometimes, and then it's also a zoomed out platformer sometimes.
The zoom out is important because then you get the super scaling effect that Sega was so known for.
So that's kind of...
There's a lot of games, a lot of their 2D games in the 90s use that zoom in, zoom out effect, which... is kind of cool and kind of gives it some depth, but also is just, it's just really violent against hand-drawn sprite art. Mm. Like it's a real
pixel murder.
Yeah. It's brutal. It's like, hey, you thought this beautiful hand-drawn sprite art looked great. Well, what do you think about it when the pixels are zoomed to 1.7 times their scale? It's gross.
Yeah. And this really has the feel of someone's tech demo that for some reason got the go ahead into a game. They're like,
not just a game, but a game bearing a major license.
Yeah. But they're like, look what we can do with this scaling. We can scale between the standard scale of a brawler with these big old sprites and the standard scale of a platformer that zoomed out. And we can go from one to the other. Isn't that cool? And we'll just make a game of this. And they did, and it's kind of there, and it doesn't look very impressive, really.
Yeah. So this game, I feel, was Sega's response to Konami's X-Men game. It's the same concept. It's a four-player simultaneous Marvel Comics-based game. But, you know, X-Men, that was easy. You got a team. You put six characters in there. Players choose. Was there a six-player version? I think it was just four players max.
Yeah, there's six.
Was there? Okay. Was there?
Yeah.
So you know, you've got X-Men. They're a team. Mm-hmm. But Spider-Man, he works alone. He's solo. No one trusts him. No one loves him. Except the Black Cat. So she's here. But then you also have Hawkeye from the Avengers.
Yeah.
And Namor the Submariner, who doesn't like anyone. What?
For some reason.
Yeah. It kind of feels like... The good licenses were, you know, snatched up by Konami or Data East, because Data East had Captain America and the Avengers.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And so Sega was left with Spider-Man, which is a good license, and then a bunch of other random characters. And it even kind of shows in the enemies you fight in this game. You've got Venom, you've got Scorpion, you've got the Green Goblin. Okay, those are all, you know, traditional Spider-Man foes. But then all the mooks are from the Hellfire Club. Those guys are X-Men nemeses. What? And then the final boss is Dr. Doom? He's the Fantastic Four's villain. It's such a weird...
Sloppy. Intellectually sloppy.
Yes, there's no rigor here whatsoever.
No rigor.
No, it's just like a really weird kind of... Here's the character licenses that Marvel was willing to give us, put them into a game and make it interesting.
I think Spider-Man is neat, actually. I'm surprised that this was a Sega game, because I remember playing this either in the arcade or just on emulator about 15 years ago when MAME was sort of a new thing. And I enjoyed playing it. It feels like playing a comic book, doing it co-op with a friend. But as far as the scaling stuff, I mean, that's sort of vulgar, you know, like we were talking about.
Wow. Yeah. I wasn't going to go that far, but sure.
Yeah. But, you know, it's neat. I mean, at the time, I can go back to thinking about playing the X-Men game or the Captain America game or this game. And just it's such a richly illustrated comic book world that you can play in. And I think that was its chief value as a game, you know, just that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the character graphics and especially the cutscenes really sort of capture the look of that sort of late 70s Marvel vibe that kind of carried into the early 80s. Like, the cutscenes, they're not animated, but they do, like, you know, changing angles and stuff. And it really kind of feels like Spider-Man and his amazing friends. You know, the character mix is different. There's no Iceman. There's no Firestar. Who even is Firestar? Instead, you have more, like, established characters. Yeah. I guess Iceman was wrapped up with X-Men anyway.
Yeah, and you do have good detail on the sprites when you're in the zoomed-in brawler mode. Yeah. And you get these good, nice comic book-looking sprites.
Yeah, they're really big.
Yeah, they're nice. Although Namor is very large and very kind of naked and is a little terrifying.
Well, he always is.
Yeah. I know.
That's why Susan Richards is like, I love you, Reed, but my heart will also be with Namor.
Because he's large and naked.
That's canon. Yeah, he's big and mostly naked. Yeah. And he's got little wings on his feet, but he's not Wyatt Wingfoot. That's someone totally different in the comics. Wow. Yeah, anyway, the scaling, I don't think it's ever really done as well or like as effectively as in the very first stage. You go through the mooks from Hellfire Club, and then you face off against Scorpion, and then you like punch Scorpion out of the way, and Venom pops out, and you beat up Venom. So it's kind of like, wow, all the bad guys are here. And once you defeat Venom, then he kind of hobbles over to this big pile of black goo that's like the same stuff his suit is made out of, and it absorbs into him, and he turns into a giant Venom. And so then there's like a huge Venom kind of fighting you as you climb scaffolding. Yeah. And it's kind of like a, what the hell?
The Ang Lee of comic book video games, like the Hulk. He turns 50 feet tall.
Yeah. Did Hulk really turn that big?
Yes. Ridiculous. In that movie, he fights a giant radioactive bulldog or something.
I get the Hulk movies mixed up because neither of them are that great.
The first one was neat, but just crazy. It was definitely done from a vision of someone who wasn't thinking about comic books.
Except, you know, he had that like crazy the edit style where the comic panels slid in and stuff. So it really captured the feel of a comic, but then the story was like its own thing.
And it has Jennifer Connelly and the guy from what's that guy's name? Sam, the guy with
Rockwell.
The mustache. Yeah, Sam Rockwell is like the general. That's pretty cool casting.
So clearly, Sam Elliott, though.
Sega should have reached into the future and got that license for this game.
Right. If only they'd been thinking 13 years ahead.
Yeah.
Those fools. Anyway, that's all kind of to the side. And then I do appreciate the fact that you're fighting Dr. Doom, but the first time you beat Dr. Doom, he explodes and you're like, no, it's a Doom bot. There are some nice nods. Like, whoever put this together put some thought, I think, into kind of making the best of the game and the license in a way that would be true to the comics, even if some of the crossover connections are weird. I guess Namor versus Dr. Doom kind of makes sense, but it's, you know, it's not Namor and Spider-Man. It's Spider-Man. It's just called Spider-Man.
Yeah, I don't think Namor and Spider-Man ever crossed paths in the comics.
They probably did. I mean,
but not frequently.
No, it wasn't not like often.
A team up.
I don't know, like Namor fought Fantastic Four a lot, and Johnny Storm and Spider-Man were pretty good buddies. So I could see some sort of, you know, like, let's fight. Oh, why must we fight? We are friends. That kind of, I don't know. Anyway.
That's how Spider-Man and the Amazing Friends got started. They wanted to have Johnny Storm and Iceman and Spider-Man, but they said, we need a girl. So they made Firestar.
Yes, exactly.
I'm just guessing. Anyway.
So.
Yeah, so.
Actually, there was some sort of like weird license issue where in the Fantastic Four cartoon, they couldn't use Torch, Johnny Storm. So instead, they had Herbie the Robot or something.
Yeah, there was another Human Torch that was earlier owned by a different company.
Timely Comics.
Yeah, or something. They had
the original, the Android Human Torch from the 40s.
Wow.
It is also, incidentally, I know last time I watched Iron Man 2, I think. There's actually a reference to the original Human Torch in the World's Fair, which is kind of cool.
Wow, that's cool.
I love all these little like Easter eggs and nods. And this game, getting back to the original topics, it does have some of those little Easter eggs. Like, even though it doesn't make sense for the Hellfire Club members to be fighting Spider-Man, it's still kind of cool. I'm like, oh, I know those guys. They didn't just, you know, come up with random punks. I mean, there are some random punks in the game, don't get me wrong, but there are also characters that you're like, oh yes, I've seen these people in the comic books, usually getting sliced apart by Wolverine, but whatever. Okay, so that was Spider-Man, and his what a crazy game! they're mildly amazing. Okay. They're somewhat impressive, but now we go on to a pair of games by Sega that was, boy, I don't know if I'd call them amazing, but they sure are interesting.
An even weirder gimmick,
yes.
For sure.
Okay, so. Did you guys ever see these games in the arcades?
Time Traveler in an
arcade. So we're talking about Time Traveler and Holosseum, games that presented themselves as like magical holography. Yes, it's actually just a mirror-based trick.
Quote-unquote holographic display, which is actually reflecting your display onto this translucent curved surface, so it makes it look like it's floating in space. And there's really nothing too complicated going on.
Yeah, it uses that same sort of reflective ghost imaging that...
Pepper's Ghost.
What?
There's a magic trick called Pepper's Ghost. A famous stage illusion where you have a half-silvered mirror.
Yeah. I was going to say that fighter pilots use to get their heads-up displays on their helmets, but yes, that also.
Yeah.
I will accept that as well.
Okay. Totally.
I've heard of that one, but sure. But yeah, it's basically using just a reflective trick, kind of like Virtual Boy used a reflective trick to come up with some sort of illusory gimmick that seems really different and far-fetched and crazy.
It looks like the display is floating in the middle of this sort of little dome thing that's on top of the arcade box.
I can tell you, I'll recount my encounter with Time Traveler.
Sure. Let's do.
The year was 1992. I don't know. I was in Gatlinburg. This is all goes back to Gatlinburg every time. The arcades. And I walked up to the Time Traveler machine. I think it cost like a dollar when everything else cost 25 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And me and my brother finally decided, hey, maybe we should put a dollar into it. And we immediately regretted it because it was really hard to play and hard to see. And I wasn't impressed. It just seemed like it would be cool in like the future, but it wasn't. I don't think it worked out that well.
So the actual game here, Time Traveler, was basically a live action QTE game.
Right. I mean, if you want to get down to it, it is a fancy new presentation format for Dragon's Lair.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
all it is. And Rick Dyer, mm-hmm. the guy who created, you know, designed Dragon's Lair as a game, not Don Bluth who did the animation.
Right.
Like this was his, I guess, his big project for the 90s was let's do the same thing, but instead of doing, you know, Laserdisc cartoons, let's do holography with full motion video. It is such a product of its times. I mean, it's basically like, you know, Silliwood was becoming really big, FMV-based games in multimedia on computers. Mm-hmm. Like, this was kind of the dawn of that. So, of course, they would take, you know, that idea and say, well, if we want to do this in the arcade, we need to make it more spectacular. Like, Dragon's Lair is now something people can do at home, so we have to come up with some sort of gimmick to make this stand apart. Do something you can't do at home. So they came up with this display concept, the fake holography. And it was really impressive. I remember seeing this at, you know, my local putt-putt in the sort of the back of the arcade area where they had the consoles that you could rent out for like 20 minutes at a time. Hmm. And I never played it because it cost a dollar and I didn't have that kind of money. I was like, I would rather play, you know, Ninja Warriors or something four times than play this once because it doesn't look that good.
Yeah.
But it's really cool looking.
It was neat.
I think I pretty much only watched other people play it, which is hard to do because it's kind of the display is oriented towards where you're standing.
I just remember it being sort of dark. But it felt like peering into a well.
Yeah. I mean, very much because you're projecting, you're projecting on glass, so you can't get that much brightness back off of it. So it is very dim and kind of floating there in a small little space. But it's also like looking at it now, it's kind of super uncomfortable because it's all this live action full motion video. And the premise is you're this like, you know, Old West dude going around time traveling and trying to survive. But so you go back to, so you've got your six shooters. And so you end up like going back to like caveman times and you have these poor little live action cavemen walking up to you and you're just shooting them in the head with your pistol. And it's like,
there's a bunch of Native Americans you shoot. And then there's robots you shoot.
Yeah, yeah,
like a obese cave woman and some other. I know this from watching the YouTube.
It's just not great from a modern perspective.
Yeah, I mean, even not accounting for the fact that QTE games style and the Dragon's Lair style are not that fun, really. It's a really expensive kind of buy-in to learn basically press buttons in this order, press the controller in this order. Mm-hmm. And there was a randomization element to this, like the scenarios that were like three scenarios per time setting.
Yeah, it would like mix
so
them
it
up.
Would randomize them. So you couldn't just, you know, master it by memorizing the button presses from start to finish. You had to adapt. But yeah, the content in addition to the concept, I'm having trouble with my words. That salad really did me in. It's very I think uncomfortable is the word to go for. but kind of cool in an interesting sort of weird, this was a thing that happened sort of way. Definitely memorable. Like, I never played the game, but I still remember it just because it really did stand out.
Yeah. So I'd say as a cultural achievement, it's noteworthy. As a game, not very good.
Yeah,
that's my verdict.
So I read in doing research that this game was making like $1 million a month or a week or something for a while.
Yeah.
But it was very short lived. Like, you know, it was the candle that burned at both ends, or the fake holography that projected at both ends. I don't know. It did something at both ends. I don't want to know. But yeah, like, I think there was a pretty quick drop off. Once the novelty wore off, people were like, oh, this looks neat, but it's not good. So almost immediately, Sega came out with a conversion kit called Holosseum, which is like a Colosseum, but holographic. Wow, it's a portmanteau. Great. Thanks, Sega. So this was a completely different game from Time Traveler, but it used the same technology. And the idea was that it was a fighting game. And, you know, this was the dawn of fighting games. Street Fighter II came out in 1991. So, you know, it was kind of right there. I would say it was like trailing behind Pit Fighter more than, you know, biting off Street Fighter. So maybe that's why it kind of sucks.
Yeah.
You have four characters to play as, and they all have very limited movesets. There's not that much difference between them. It feels very clumsy. Pit Fighter, I think, is a good touchstone for this game.
I think Colosseum is a contender for one of the most obscure video games of all time. Just based on the technology, and that it's just a game no one has ever heard of or played. And it has a cool name.
Yeah,
I never saw it in the wild.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw Time Traveler, but not Holosseum. Or if I did see Holosseum, I was like, whatever.
Yeah, I never saw it. No.
But this did not use digitized
it was pixel graphics,
right?
Yeah, it was pixel graphics.
Right.
It's, you know, basically just imagine a completely generic, kind of mediocre one-on-one fighter, and then imagine it floating in a dome, and that's what you get.
On a black background, essentially.
So, yeah, no background because it's on the translucent screen.
In space.
So Sega was definitely casting its line far and wide, hoping for a bite. I think if you want to look at a better attempt at the fighting game genre that they came out with, again, 1991, 92, so right around the time Street Fighter was first hitting and making its ripples, you can look instead at Golden Axe. Oh, wait, no, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, you went ahead, skipped out to Duel.
That's right. Okay, so I guess it wasn't that inventive. Let's talk about Golden Axe, the Duel. We'll go out of order here.
Sure.
Okay, that was a little later, but yeah.
So this is another, like, this kind of combines the scaling of Spider-Man with the fighting of Holosseum and no fake holographic technology or QTEs. It is a one-on-one fighting game starring Golden Axe characters. But the only Golden Axe characters I really know are Axe Battler,
the ones from the first game,
and Gilius Thunderhead, and what was it, Sonya
Blade?
Blade?
Yeah,
Sonya Blade was Mortal Kombat.
That's a Mortal Kombat character.
Sonya
Thunderhead.
No, that was Gilius.
That's Gilius's name. I don't know the lady.
Dunderhead.
The lady. I can't remember her name. I'm sorry, lady. You're very pretty, and I think you're cool. So don't take it personally.
She has awesome magic.
She does, and she has a really cool sword, which is very impressive. Okay, this is going nowhere. Anyways,
they're in this game.
Yeah. So they are in this game. Yeah, and there's other characters.
Tell me more about this sword. Details.
It kills people and stuff. Yeah.
So one of the weird things about this game is that it keeps the Golden Axe magic system, even though you're in a one-on-one fighter now. And every once in a while, those little imps that you all know and hate from Golden Axe will run on the screen. And if you fight them, you can get magic bottles out of them. And that's how you do your special attacks in this fighting game while the fighting game is going on. So that always seemed kind of weird to me. I'm not really sure. I haven't spent time with the game, so I'm not really sure how well that worked in practice. But it seems like a weird choice for a fighting game.
Yeah, I don't think I ever played this in the arcade. I feel like I saw it one time. Maybe I did play it, but there was a neat, a little period of time after Street Fighter 2 where I was actually excited by interpretations of other series turned into one-on-one fighting games. I thought that was kind of cool. And then it got old really fast.
Yeah, there weren't a lot. There was, this and Double Dragon and a couple of others, but it didn't happen as often as you might think.
I mean, didn't they? I mean, eventually they made Smash Brothers.
Well, that's
that was way later.
I mean, there's a Turtles one-on-one fighter.
Turtles,
Tournament Fighter.
Tournament Fighter from Turtles. There was
One-on-one Pac-Man battles.
No, you're just making things up.
Tetris.
Tetris battle guiding.
Tetris, yeah.
So actually, one of the
L-Block guy is overpowered.
One of the interesting things about Golden Axe the Duel is that it's an early weapons-based fighter. There weren't many of those. Like, people always talk about Weapon Lord as being by Namco as being like the first big weapon-based fighter, but that was 1995, I want to say, 94. This was before that. So Sega beat everyone to the punch and got no credit for it.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, like the final boss is Golden Axe, and he uses an axe, and he's golden. It's actually very literal.
And I guess it kind of like doing a weapons fighter kind of fits with the scaling camera thing they were doing, because it gives everyone more reach. So there's a little more of a sense of scale and spacing. You're not always as close in as you are in other fighters. So that maybe puts sort of their scaling tech
to a little bit
of good use there, and that you can zoom out when you need to.
Yeah, like you would see that sort of scaling technique done a lot in other games later. Like
Samurai Showdown had that, didn't
it? I think so, yeah. Then there was Outfoxies. Did you guys ever play that?
No.
That's probably worth a micro episode in and of itself. Outfoxies is, I want to say it was by Taito. I could be wrong, but I think Taito. And it was like a four-player brawling game across kind of like these platforms. It was like Smash Brothers minus the Nintendo characters 4 or 5 years before Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like Outfoxies. I've only ever seen it in Japanese arcades and retro arcades, where it's just kind of like sitting there by itself and everyone's like, what is that? Yep. Nanda. But it's an interesting game. And this kind of does that same sort of thing without the platforms, but it kind of gets to that, like, hey, let's have a fighting game with a dynamic viewpoint. And of course, Sega would explore that in other ways with Virtua Fighter, but we'll talk about that later.
We'll get to that whole set.
But before we talk about that, which is coming up actually pretty soon, I do want to talk about Golden Axe Revenge of Death Adder, which I got out of sequence. That is Golden Axe 2, basically. And I realized watching videos of this and researching about it that I've never played it or even seen it.
Yeah, I don't think I've actually played it. I think I'd seen it a few times. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty much more Golden Axe.
It is, but like one of the playable characters is a centaur woman.
Yeah, there's a centaur woman.
She's not in the duel, though, is she?
I don't think so.
She seems like she would be really overpowered. Just turn around and kick people in the face and they die.
It had centaur. And for some reason, the dwarf is riding in a barbarian's backpack.
Yeah.
You know, in this I'm not sure why.
You know, the vehicular element becomes its own thing. The weirdest thing is that the centaur lady can ride mounts.
Can she? I never
she does.
That. Okay.
the videos I was watching, one of them, she like punches a dude off a giant praying mantis.
Yeah, the praying mantis.
And then she hops on the praying mantis. And when she rides on the mantis, her body morphs so that she becomes just a human.
Oh, okay. That's how
it's not like a horse riding on top of a mantis with a person grafted in the front of the horse.
That would have been cool.
Which would have been very difficult. No, she metamorphoses into a standard, you know, just a normal human so that she can ride a mantis.
Yeah,
there's some weird stuff going on in this game.
Yeah, the mounts in this one, I think they felt like they had to, you know, everyone loved riding on the dragon and riding on the little tail flippy thing in the first one. So they felt like they had to like keep going and outdo that. So there's like a fire breathing mantis, and there's a giant scorpion that makes electric sparks from its claws. And there's a lot of weird, cool stuff in it. And there's other like interactive things too. Like there's sometimes the enemies will like bring up this little like trebuchet and like shoot rocks at you, and you can actually like take command of it and shoot rocks back at them. And
wow.
Yeah.
That is bonkers.
Yeah. There's a lot of weird stuff.
And this also does the screen scaling thing. Like, I guess this was Sega's thing now. Everything has got to zoom in and out.
Well, so it sort of turns the level 90 degrees sometimes and goes into the screen for a little while.
What?
It doesn't actually, it doesn't rotate.
It's not like voxels.
So you're going along side scrolling, but then you get to a point where you have to walk into the screen instead, and it scales stuff towards you and sometimes has boulders running down the screen at you as you're doing it.
Right. So it's like Thunderblade or something.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You just turn and go into the screen for a bit and then continue on to the side.
Man, they were really trying to come up with some,
they liked this tech. I mean, and it looked really nice.
Well, I mean, it's like, clearly their heart was set on the third dimension, but it was hard to express that with their, you know, model or System 16 boards.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess Golden Axe 2 is kind of like where one of those places where what they could do with that technology sort of reached its natural limit. And you end up with a very strange game. I need to sit down and play this sometime. I didn't even see the parts where it scales. I thought it was like zooming in and out, but I guess not.
Yeah, no, it's just these short little segments, but yeah, you're traveling into the screen instead of along the side for a while.
I've never played it, but
you're in good company.
My brother wrote a song called Centaur Girlfriend a long time ago.
Was it about her?
I was thinking I need to show this game to my brother. He said this female centaurs don't exist, but he rides around on a centaur girlfriend as part of the lyrics. So I don't know what a female centaur would be called.
Centaur. Well, she's in this game. She's kind of cute. Yeah. So yeah, probably like cool.
That's all I got to say. Nothing important.
Anyways.
All right, so we talked about the limitations of 2D technology, and that's okay, because now we're into 1992.
Yes.
When Sega said, the hell with the second dimension, let's go in on polygons, and kicked off the Virtua franchise. I guess it's a franchise. It's
pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, games aren't really connected, and there are games that use the same kind of technology that aren't called Virtua. But it was kind of, I guess, like an umbrella brand, aegis to combine all these games, to bring them together and make people say, Virtua, I know what that means. Mm-hmm. That means floaty polygons.
Yeah, so it's interesting. They knew they wanted this 3D tech, and they actually went and talked to people at NASA, because NASA had simulators, 3D simulators that they were working on. And so evidently the people that developed this new board for them went and talked to those people and kind of put together their minds and decided to come up with some hardware where they could use this in the service of games. And they did it. And they made the Model 1 board.
Right. And that was headed up by Yu Suzuki and AM2 Arcade. What does AM2 stand for? Arcade Amusement Machines? I don't know. Advanced Idea Mechanics. Yeah, the Model 2 board was not the first 3D board. The first 3D board was Namco's.
Yeah, Namco had one before this.
I can't remember, but it came out. It launched in like 1987. It's or 1988. We talked about it on an episode that's coming up that we recorded recently, and I cannot remember what it's called. But that was 1988.
What game was it?
I don't remember.
Well, so Namco had a 3D racing game, Winning Run.
Okay. Which is probably like how come they didn't call it Pole Position 3D? Failure of branding.
Failure, yeah.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah, no, so Namco had a 3D racing game, and Atari also had one.
They had Hard Driving. Which was just like a driving game. It wasn't really racing. It was very slow.
Yeah. And they were both
fairly hard.
It was very difficult.
But they were fairly clunky, like slow frame rate and very, very simple 3D. Like kind of Star Fox level, low poly.
By 1992, you also had games like Stun Runner, which were much faster and more exciting. But there was still something about Sega's presentation.
It's the most important thing I can say about the Virtua games is just the frame rate.
Yes,
blew
60
me
frames
away.
A second.
I mean, that was incredible. We had seen kind of polygon games before on, you know, even on home computers up to that point, but they were extremely slow and jerky. And when I walked into an arcade and saw Virtua Fighter for the first time, it just blew me away because it was so smooth and fluid.
So yeah, this first game, Virtua Racer, here is my note: speed, resolution, and frame rate made all the difference. These games were much faster, especially like Virtua Fighter is kind of a slow paced fighting game, but Virtua Racing, like, it felt breakneck speed. Like, it was just so fast at the time. And the scenery and environments, like, go up and down. It was kind of like Outrun, but so much more immersive.
Yeah.
And it did have, like, this kind of high resolution. It did have this kind of high resolution widescreen format that just really, like, pulled you in. And again, yeah, like you said, 60 frames a second. So it was, like, super smooth. And even though everything was, you know, flat shaded polygons, just like very simple blocky shapes, it didn't really matter because it was going so fast. Yeah. It was so silky smooth. Like it was like nothing else that anyone had ever seen.
Compared to the earlier stuff, it was also getting some more polygons in there. So even with the flat shading, it had a lot more detail than the really early 3D stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was just really impressive. And this was actually, this was the very beginning on this board. It started off as a tech demo for this board as they were developing it. Like, can we do this? Can we make a game out of this? And then the answer was, yes, do it. Make it a game. And it was great.
I feel like Virtua Racing has aged very well just because of the frame rate thing. It's still really playable and it's incredible.
And super arcade friendly. So the way this came, you had an upright cabinet, you had a sit down two player versus cabinet. And then you had the deluxe cab, which was another sit down one styled like an F1 car that had force feedback, I believe, in both the steering wheel and the seat.
Wow.
So it was this very immersive experience. And then any of these could actually be hooked together. They had this little fiber optic connection. You could put up to 8 players at once. So you could have these 8 cabs or these 8 F1 sit downs running along the back of your arcade.
I've never seen that in person. That would have been amazing.
I don't think I saw it with the sit downs, but I did see at least somewhere in the 4 to 8 range of cabs hooked up once in arcade. And it was definitely, a centerpiece for the time.
That must have been just something like the sit down linked cabinet. That's got to be something that only showed up at Sega centers, like their amusement centers.
There was a game
that would be so expensive.
Final Lap Twin, I saw hooked up in an arcade, 2 or 3 of them. I think it may have been Twin first because it was, you could hook 2 machines together. But I'm pretty sure I went to an arcade with 4. You know, this was 2D sprite racing linked together, which is, it was impressive.
Yeah, and they did this, I think Daytona USA, which we'll get to later, did the same thing. And at least one, I think they actually had this option for both of them. I forgot, I came across it somewhere. I hadn't seen this in person, but there was an option where you could have basically like an announcer set up. So someone could actually like call the race as you had 8 players racing.
Wow.
And do it like a sports broadcast and with like an extra screen up above, like running highlights.
I think it's interesting that for Sega's first 3D racing game, the style of racing they went with was Formula One, as opposed to, something more like the rally car driving of OutRun or stock car racing or something along those lines. They went with F1, which is like kind of big in Japan, really big in Europe, and
yeah, that might
just
be
an empty fart here. Like no one in America really cares about F1. It's one of those weird things that I've kind of stumbled across as I've been researching things for Game Boy and NES. I'm like, there are so many of these F1 games and they never come to, or they rarely came to the US, but this was, obviously this one hit everywhere because it was such a big technological leap.
It was so impressive. No one cared what the car
looked like. Yeah. It's interesting that they went with F1 that, as opposed to something that would be bigger in the US market, which was, a really huge market, maybe the biggest market at the time. But I guess
it was originally the demo for their new board, so they may not have even been thinking that far ahead when they started it. May have just been thinking about the local market.
I mean, everything Yu Suzuki does was kind of a pet project, so maybe this is just, more of where his passion was.
I'd like to say something just about the technology of the 3D that I think I remember, which is that the Virtua series used, square-shaped primitives, I think, instead of triangle polygons, which were common later. So there was a point when they were trying to translate these games to other consoles or even PC translations, and it was tricky because they were quadrilateral.
Split it all into tries.
Yeah, the Saturn used quadrilaterals.
Yeah, it was.
So these games, I guess, would have been a natural fit for Saturn.
Yeah. But then after that, every other console seemed, I think, used the triangle. There's a term for that. I don't remember it right offhand, but the triangle shaped primitives.
Triads.
Triads. There was no rule at the time in the early to mid 90s that triangles were going to be the polygon of choice for everyone. I mean, they make sense because they're the simplest polygon, but people tried quadrilaterals. They tried, there was that one game engine that used spheres or circles. Everything looked all kind of rubbery and round naturally, voxels and other things like that. People tried different things and for whatever reason, they ultimately went with triangles.
Yeah. I think it's part of the distinctive visual style of the Sega games. It's those square shaped,
definitely
primitives there.
Lends a certain aesthetic that sort of carries through.
basically, once virtual racing came out, it was everyone's day at the races. It was all, not all triangles all the time or all polygons all the time, but basically half their output from this point on, and increasingly, you know, more than that after a few years, would be polygon-based 3D games. So all of a sudden, like, Sega, the company that did cool, awesome things with sprites, started to make fewer and fewer games with sprites and superscalers because, you know, as much as those looked great and were very distinctive, they were also old news, and that's not why people were going to arcades. They were going to arcades for the newest and hottest and freshest games and experiences and visuals. So, yeah, from this point on, a ton of these games are polygon-based. Yep. Starting with Star Wars Arcade, which I'm very sad I never actually saw in the arcades. I saw Star Wars Trilogy years later, but not Star Wars Arcade. I only am familiar with the 32X conversion of the game.
Yeah.
I feel like there might have been one of these at Disneyland at some point in their Star Wars section, but I'm not entirely sure.
I have the 32X version. I've played that. That's cool.
But yeah, the actual arcade. So I don't know that I've actually seen it in the arcade either, but it was an impressive setup. So you had this 2-seat console, basically. And then this separate 50-inch rear projection display. So this huge, huge-ass display. Wow. And then it was designed to be played, like, a design with two players, and you basically have one person piloting and one person being a free-roaming gunner. Wow. So,
what was that? Oh, crap, I can't remember what the game was called. Lucky and Wild?
Was that?
Oh, that was a game where one person drove and the other shot, but it was like a 2D kind of Outrun-ish sort of shooter game. Yeah, could you play this solo? You could, right? You could pick to be one or the other.
Yeah, so like but when you're solo, like, you can only fire where you're flying. So like Star Fox or something. Mm. So you fire at the center of the screen while you're flying. So you can play it that way, but it's sort of a different. It's a much restricted experience compared to when you've got someone who can actually shoot at the whole screen.
But Ben, canonically, X-Wings are single man. Yeah. Fire. They're one man snub fighters.
It's true.
So why is there a second person in? That's only for Y-Wings and for B-Wings, Ben.
You have to ask Sega.
This is very upsetting to me.
Cancel the podcast. My canon? Just cancel it.
This is why they lost the license. This is why it's with EA now. They're like, what are you asses doing?
They made a second one after this.
That's true.
one was just.
It is very impressive looking. I like the fact that the first stage of this game, you know, going back and watching videos of it, the first stage is a trench run, but it's not the Death Star trench run. It's a Super Star Destroyer trench run.
That's the second stage, I think.
Is that?
Yeah, because there's fighting TIE. You have to, like, take down 20 TIE fighters in space.
I thought that was all part of, like, the first stage. It was, flows one into the other.
I think it all runs together, yeah.
It was kind of structured like the original Atari arcade Star Wars game.
Yeah.
Just, like, with, you know, polygons as opposed to vectors and new setups. So, yeah, you start by fighting TIE fighters, but you, like, fly into a fleet of Star Destroyers.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, then it just kind of, like, once you've hit your targets, you've destroyed 20 TIE fighters, then you segue into the Super Star Destroyer trench run.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much exactly the same as the Death Star trench run in Atari's arcade or Atari Star Wars, but it's with the Super Star Destroyer.
Because why not?
Yeah, why not?
Well, because they wanted more stages. There's going to be the actual Death Star trench run later.
And then when you blow up the Super Star Destroyer, it, like, breaks into triangles, starting with the back and just kind of disintegrates.
Yeah, the old classic disintegration. Yes.
No planetary explosion rings here.
No. It was before that time. But yeah, so
before the special editions. Before the dark times.
So yeah, you shoot down TIE fighters, and then you do a Super Star Destroyer run, and then you shoot down some more TIE fighters, and then you do the second Death Star into the superstructure dealy. Because this is all Return of the Jedi. You've got Ackbar giving out your missions. Mm-hmm.
And I strongly encourage everyone to find Japanese footage of this game, because Ackbar in Japanese...
It's kind of terrifying.
So good. No, it's so great. He's like your stern fish uncle.
Yeah,
I don't know.
He's pretty great.
I have one of those.
No, actually, Ackbar is great. It's the droid voices that are terrifying in the Japanese one. They're kind of squeaky. Someone came on over the radio
super
at
cute.
Some point. Yeah.
Like C-3PO. What does he sound like?
Okay. Don't look at me.
It would be too. I'm not going to sit here and pretend, you know, Japanese.
Oh, you might as well.
No, you're not going to trap me. It's a trap.
There you go. You got it out. You got it
all
in
right,
there.
All right. Yeah.
All right, one last look at a 2D game before we take a break. And that is Outrunners, which, you know, the sequel to Outrun, as the name suggests, but feels kind of like a product out of time. I mean, this was going head to head against virtual racing.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a very different kind of game, but like, you know, this is a more impressive adaptation of Superscalar Racing. But would you really look at this and then look at Virtual Racing and say, no, I'm going to go with the one that looks like it was made 6 years ago? Kind of a tough sell.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays you can sell it because, you know, the early 3D stuff just looks like really clunky old 3D, whereas the sprite stuff is pretty.
But this was about, the time, you know,
yeah.
contemporaneously.
Yep.
Like, there are a lot of good arcade games that went badly overlooked in the 90s that hold up a lot better now than some of the early 3D stuff, but they were overlooked because they weren't 3D. Stuff like Outfoxies. That game's really cool.
Taking a word for that.
Yeah, like, no one really knew about it back then. And so it's been this kind of crazy little obscurity in the corner of video game history. Outrunners is kind of the same way. Like, people don't really seem to know. Like, of all the Outrun games, I would say this is probably the least best known.
Yeah.
The worst known, I guess, if you will.
The worst, best, least known.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Precisely. Thank you for
I've never known of this game.
I didn't know about
it. I mean, it is Outrun, but way more insane. Like, you have, I think, 6 different cars to choose from. And it uses the same branching path structure for its roads, but the roads that you, like, the path you travel is completely impossible. You start out in San Francisco and you can, like, drive on a bridge over the Pacific Ocean to Hong Kong. And then you drive out over another bridge into Kenya. Like, this is one road trip where you end up in Kenya.
Do these bridges take you through the stratosphere?
Yeah, you've got the world's greatest engineering achievement going on, and they're just driving off around.
It's like Tesseract racing. I don't know. This game does not really fuss with realism. It's just like, let's come up with as many cool settings around the world as we can, and depending on the path you take, you'll see different continents. And in between, there are some little spans of bridges, and they're very efficient bridges.
Which is fair, because, you know, if you handed me the Outrun engine and said, you know, here, make some new, weird, cool-looking stuff with it, sure, that sounds like a good direction to go with that. So, yeah.
It's us again, and what better way to kick off the amazing second half of this podcast than with a discussion of maybe the single most important game to show up in this entire episode, and that is Virtua Fighter. Or Bacha Fighter.
Virtua Fighter. Yes. So, this kicked off an entire genre pretty handily. This was basically the first big fully...
So this was 93?
90, yeah.
So, like, a year after Street Fighter II basically sort of said, hey, this is how you do fighting games, Sega came along and said, hey, this is how you do fighting games in polygons. This is the future.
Yep, and it's pretty much defined the genre. So it's got all the things we think about having in a 3D fighting game today. Well, not all of them, but a whole bunch of the standard things. No panty shots.
That's a big part of them now.
But I mean, so the basic setup is similar to a 2D fighting game where you have, you know, your two guys, you're one on one, you got your special moves and so on. But then you're in this 3D space. And so you've got a ring, you can ring out people, which is kind of new. And then it really solidified a whole lot of things that are just completely standard now. Like when you knock someone out, it does these replays from different camera angles because, you know, now that it's 3D, you can do that and it looks cool. So you get these like KO replays and you get special win pose animations and just a whole bunch of the things you think of coming as par for the course in a 3D fighter.
Yeah, it's a more dramatic, cinematic approach to the fighting game.
Yeah.
The you know, the camera zoom in and out that kind of happened and abused pixel art design in other fighting games could just happen naturally here without any degradation because you have polygons that, you know, you can move the camera around a little bit and break away from the flat 2D plane. You can zoom in, camera. You can, you know, change your perspective from high to low or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that this game blew me away the first time I ever saw it. I actually remember what the room looked like when I first saw it. It was so memorable. Like the orientation of the game near a window and the wall. And it's just strange because I just approached it from the side and I said, oh my gosh, what is this game? I feel like we had been, me and my brother had been looking at Mortal Kombat around that time as the pinnacle of fighting games. Was that contemporary with this? Exactly.
Yeah, close. Mortal Kombat was 92.
Very okay, close. Yeah, so this was just like a year later.
And we saw Virtua Fighter and like, whoa, this is the future. We got to get one of these when we start an arcade in about 20 years. We never did.
Yeah.
And make it was too late. It's been 19 years. Yeah. So, oh no, wait. It's been 24 years.
Oh, so I still
years.
Have time.
Never mind. Okay. It's too late. You blew it.
But and it did represent up. Like a very different direction from sort of where the 2D fighters have been heading. Because the 2D fighters, that was sort of established at this point. And so you had people going for like more extreme, you had more violent like Mortal Kombat, or you had people just trying weird stuff. And so this sense, the hook is, look how cool this is in 3D. In other respects, it went very much back to basics. And you had characters with more realistic fighting styles. You didn't have blood. You didn't have a lot of like over the top special moves. It was much closer to the things that people could actually do.
It was couched more in the terms of real martial arts.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some elements of realistic fighting styles in something like Street Fighter, but they got really fanciful really quickly.
Well, Street Fighter was drawing from movies, from the martial arts tradition in East Asia. And so you had a lot of stuff that originally came from styles, but was very over the top for a movie setting.
Right.
So people flying across the screen and then, of course, fireballs and things. Whereas this was much closer to actual styles. And I think a lot of that was the influence of the lead designer, who was Seiichi Ishii, who, if I can do a momentary cross episode promotion, we're going to be talking about more in a mini, because he went on to do some other fighters for Square with Dream Factory. And he also directed Tekken 1 and 2. And you can really see this influence going through all these games where he's drawing from real world fighting styles for his characters.
I definitely remember the thread that goes from Virtua Fighter to Tekken. I remember thinking when Tekken came out, it was like Virtua Fighter. So I didn't know they were
director. Yeah. He went to Namco to do that after he was at Sega.
Very cool.
Yeah, and you could see other companies, other developers trying to do the things that Virtua Fighter did in 3D with the limitations of 2D technology, like the very first King of Fighters, and I think before it, Art of Fighting, tried to adopt the idea of three dimensionality by having planes of action where your characters could jump,
sidestep,
sidestep projectiles and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it never quite worked. Whereas this, it made sense. It wasn't, you know, something that had been sort of superimposed on an existing concept. It was just a natural extension of the idea that you are fighting in a 3D space. So of course you have some limited range of 3D maneuvers. This wasn't a fully 3D fighting game. Like, you didn't have free movement through the arena, but you had more ability to kind of move within that 3D space. So it really did kind of break the fighting game out of the limitations of the second dimension. Obviously, I mean, in a natural sort of way, but in a very like fluid and visually impressive way as well.
It also seemed like this was really a kind of dam-breaking moment just for 3D in general. Even though it came after we had Virtua Racing, which is very impressive, but it seems like that kind of stayed within its sort of subgenre of racing games. Whereas here, now that you had convincing 3D characters, everyone else in the game industry was looking at this and saying, wow, we can do stuff with characters in 3D that looks good. I mean, it looks very primitive to us from today's perspective, but at the time it looked convincing. And we can do all kinds of stuff with this. And so I was reading that people in all kinds of different companies were looking at Virtua Fighter, and that's when they decided to really go all in on 3D. And in fact, evidently the people who were developing the PlayStation at Sony after the deal with Nintendo for the Super Famicom CD fell through, they were looking at this and saying, we need to go all in. We can do 3D characters. The people behind Tomb Raider were looking at this and saying, we can do a 3D action adventure. And this just sort of opened the floodgates for 3D character-based video games.
Yeah, and it's not like the idea of 3D graphics hadn't been floating around already. No. When did the Jaguar launch? That was like 93. Yeah, 93. Mm-hmm. So that was 3D capable hardware to a certain degree.
On the Amiga and the Atari ST, there were many polygon-based games that were mostly like a first-person tank or plane.
Oh, yeah. That had been around
forever. Starship or whatever. Yeah, there weren't very many that were characters that I recall, you know.
Yeah, it takes a lot fewer polygons to make something that looks like, you know, a triangular plane or a square tank than... So, yeah, I mean, you had the game Tank was... How old was that? A long time before this, but...
Yeah, well, there's... I don't know, there's just... We mentioned hard driving. There's... there's a game called iRobot, I think, that was 3D polygonal.
Yeah, so people have been doing stuff. Yeah. People have been doing stuff where you could sort of in a situation where you could get away with extremely low poly stuff. And there's a lot of genres where you can make that work. I mean, again, Star Fox, you know, back on the SNES hardware, obviously, with some extra chips. But, you know, you have spaceships built of really low polys and that kind of works.
Right. But you have the complexity of these characters and the incredibly smooth frame rate and the high resolution.
Yep.
And again, it's something that sets the game apart, and no competitors had been able to match that. So obviously this was a huge deal. I mean, this game was kind of a landmark. I didn't spend a lot of time in arcades at this point, so I didn't really spend a lot of time with Virtua Fighter, but I was definitely aware of it and definitely aware of like the fact that, hey, this was pretty much the future of games. It had a ways to go, but this would be where everything would be heading in the future. Let's see. I fortunately missed out on the Genesis conversion of Virtua Fighter 2.
I have that one.
Yeah, it's awful.
It's sprite based.
It is absolutely wretched. Yeah. It totally misses the point.
Yeah. So whereas
wasn't there a 32X version of Virtua Fighter?
I think so.
I don't know if I have that one. I have Virtua Racing on 32X, which is really cool. Yeah. And there was actually Virtua Racing on the Genesis that had VFX chip or something. It's the only one.
Yeah, and it costs like $100.
Yeah.
The conversion of Virtua games to home hardware was kind of the benchmark that Sega set for itself with the Saturn and the Dreamcast. Right.
And that's where Virtua Fighter actually found a home. You know, became
Saturn.
It actually wasn't in Japan, I think, but in the US it was a pack in with Saturn to sell it.
It made me want a Saturn. Yeah. I didn't get one until later, but I didn't have it either. I wanted it just to play Virtua Fighter.
I'm thinking the US home conversion of Virtua Fighter was refined over the Japanese, wasn't that correct?
Yeah,
I feel like the very first Virtua Fighter that came out on Saturn was kind of like, if I'm remembering right. And then the revised version, Virtua Fighter.
There's a remix version.
Okay,
that came out later. So the original Virtua Fighter is almost entirely flat shaded polygons. I think there's texture on the character's eyes, and that was it.
Yeah.
But then it was only, you know, within like a year after Virtua Fighter came out, a bunch of more games started coming out that actually textured the polygons. And suddenly Virtua Fighter looked kind of old next to them. So they actually re-put out a remix version that basically textured everything. So you had textured backgrounds and more texture on the characters.
Yeah, I have I have both of them, I think.
Okay.
I got them with my Saturn. Like, you could get the remix for cheap or a reduced price when it came out.
If you had the original.
Yeah, if you had the first one. I feel like it played off Virtua Fighter 2 technology at that point.
Yeah, and Virtua Fighter 2 obviously also used the texture.
So moving on, another Sega film license. This one kind of I don't know. It's Alien 3, The Gun.
The Gun.
There were a handful of Alien 3 licensed games. I really liked the one that Probe did for Super NES, even though I recognize in hindsight it has a lot of design issues. It was still pretty engrossing, kind of exploratory, mission-based, a little bit ahead of its time in some ways, and it really captured the aesthetic of the film, I thought. This, not so much, though. It's a strange, you know, first-person gun game.
It's a very frenetic light gun game, so you're going through these corridors and environments at pretty high speed, and it basically just throws aliens at you. It's sort of, I feel like it's a you know, front of the arcade spectacle kind of game.
And this is sprite-based game.
It's sprite-based. Yeah. This is back to Super Scalar stuff,
I think. But yeah, it does have the super scaling because you're moving through corridors in a first-person perspective.
And I feel like, I don't know, I didn't actually manage to read up. I didn't see how it was made, but it looks like digitized assets, maybe. I mean, it kind of...
Yeah, they're definitely digitized.
Looks like you've got, like alien models that have been photographed and digitized.
Yeah. You have... basically, like, every kind of alien that had existed in the films to that point, including, like, the dog alien from Alien 3, you know, chest bursters and face huggers and everything, like, those all come flying at you, but they're all, like, the same digitized images. So everything starts to look really fake really fast. It's just, like, cardboard cutout city.
So you just get so mad at it, you just want to shoot them all.
I guess.
Here's this fake stuff.
And it's like super like spraying alien blood everywhere. That's basically most of
just,
the game.
It doesn't. It's just like there's so much happening and none of it seems to have any weight to it. You know, if you compare this to Virtua Cop, which we'll talk about in a little bit, this is just like just the screen is full of things to shoot and there's no real substance to it.
I feel like the high speed light gun games were kind of scaling light gun games were kind of going in this weird specialized direction like this, and the much later on the list we've got a Jurassic Park licensed one that's the same sort of thing. It's just this hyperactive throw a million things at you as fast as possible, and it's just the spectacle of having all this stuff splashing over the screen.
Well, this is around the time that you know, you had Revolution X and you had Terminator 2. Like, those were really big games. And so I think Sega was kind of looking at those and saying, we need to do that.
Yeah.
And like they decided to do it with an alien game in which there's literally just, like, one alien. Oh, two aliens if you count the one that's inside Ripley.
Oh, in
like,
the movie.
Yeah, in the film. Like, it is not a movie full of aliens. There's one. It goes back to the original Alien. It's just, you know, in a scenario where no one is able to fight back against it, so it's just kind of slowly picking them off. It's much more of a horror movie, like a character drama, than it is an action movie like Aliens. Although this game does begin in the Sulaco, so you know the crashed Sulaco. You have to fight your way out to get to the surface of Fiorina 478 or whatever the planet's called. I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, it's like a game, so it needs a million targets. So you're a Marine versus a million aliens. It has very little to do with the movie. It's Alien 3 side story. Alien 3 Gaiden.
Yeah, I guess. This is one of those alien license games that really cheapens the concept of the Xenomorph. Not quite as badly as Colonial Marines, because nothing will be quite as bad as Colonial Marines. But definitely, it's no Alien Isolation. Let's say that. Next up. Daytona USA, another really big one. This is a Sega's second polygonal racing game, but it's a very different kind of game than Virtua Racing.
Yeah, so it's essentially the next gen for their 3D stuff. So this was the Model 2 board following the Model 1 board. So essentially more powerful. And now they could like fully texture map everything, put a lot more polygons on the screen, and still have it running at 60 frames per second.
What year was this? 94.
We are up to
93,
I think.
Is it still 93? Yeah, this stuff moved really fast.
Yeah, this game feels to me like the true successor to Outrun, because it's so gloriously blue skied and colorful and bright and vivid. And
once you had all these texture maps,
I mean,
you could
it's not the same as Outrun. I just mean like,
yeah, I feel like spiritually, Sega Rally Championship is more like the successor to Outrun in a lot of ways, whereas this is kind of in between. It's not as limited as Virtua Racing. It's not, you know, it's not based on Formula One, so it's not as structured. But at the same time, it's still not as open and like, go have a racing adventure as Outrun.
So this was kind of, it
definitely gets there. It's closer.
This was stock car racing. So you had, and it gave you some choices. You could choose, you could pick like manual or automatic transmission. And it had some different modes. You could do checkpoint style racing you could do versus head to head racing. And like I said earlier, like Virtua Racing, you could link up to 8 cabinets and do these big multiplayer races with it. And it also, it just like the additional polygons, they put all kinds of weird stuff in this. So it had all kinds of weird secrets. Like the tracks had these interactive elements that you wouldn't even necessarily know about, but that you can actually interact with by weird things like hitting the start button when you pass them. So yeah, this is wild. I never actually saw this in action in the arcade, but I was reading on the beginner's track, evidently at one point along it, there's actually a slot machine. And if you hit start button when you're passing it, it'll actually run slots. And like, if you get 777, you get 7 seconds added to your lap time. Huh. And like ridiculous things like that are like sprinkled through the game. It's got all these weird Easter eggs.
This is cool. I don't know. This is a classic to me. I still seen this sitting in arcades up to the present or randomly.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I read is
I played it years and years after for some reason.
It was evidently one of the highest grossing arcade cabinets of all time.
That makes sense.
Everyone had this. Yeah.
That backs up what I just said. Yeah. Thankfully. I didn't just make it up. But, you know, Daytona USA, there was a neat version of it on the PS3 not too long ago. They just did a sort of like a straight remake of it that you could download, and it's just really fun.
Cool.
It's just this, you know, same sort of blocky graphics, but it's just really cheerful and fun and smooth. It's just really well done.
Yeah, I mean, it's still low poly by today's standards, but with all the texture mapping they had on now, it still looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You know, you go back to Virtua Racing and you can appreciate it, but it clearly looks old because it's mostly untextured. Whereas at this point, you're getting some really, you know, nice aesthetics.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is the design of the cars themselves. Like the sort of the famous car in this game is a sort of like powder blue and red. So it just has like this, you know, sort of visual style that really pops. Yeah. It really catches your eye.
Bright.
Yeah.
Iconic looking.
Mm-hmm. So, it really does kind of get to the, like you said, blue sky thing that Sega did so well. And it brings that into the polygonal realm. Whereas Virtua Racing, you know, looked really impressive, but didn't have like a strong color scheme or visual identity besides, you know, polygons. Whereas this game definitely has that Sega aesthetic that you associate with the company.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels like a true Sega game. And this gets the voice, Daytona, you know, a Sega voice.
As the Game Over song.
Yeah. I don't remember how that goes.
It's like, game over,
yeah. Sounds about right.
There's also evidently hidden songs in it. Speaking of weird secrets, evidently there's some combinations of initials you can enter in the high score list that like unlock secret music.
Huh.
Like there's an old Virtua Racing track in it, and there's some other tracks you can unlock that way.
That's cool.
Yeah, I feel like this is probably a game that we could do an entire episode on if we knew anything about racing, which I don't. Nah, but I'm sure someone who is like super into racing games would have a lot to say about this game.
We should play it again a lot, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Yeah, but cool, I still can't speak about racing as an expert. Yeah, whereas, you know, someone like Jazz Rignall could be like, oh, well, let me tell you about racing and go on for an hour. Whereas I lack that ability. Now, if you want to know about Star Trek, I'm your man.
It's based on NASCAR, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Stock car racing.
There's a place up by Falls Lake in our city, which is called like Rum Runner Hill or something. You know, like that's where NASCAR was born, I think, in the state where they were. The moonshiners are running away from the cops.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I did not know that. So they started driving in circles, and the cops were chasing in the circles. And the Yakety Sax played. It was great.
Well, there's also one of the oldest NASCAR speedways. It's right by my house, the Okanichi Speedway. It's a hiking trail now in Hillsboro.
Yeah, that's it. Hillsboro, yeah. And there was another speedway right at the corner of the Beltline and Falls of the Noose. That used to be there before they built the Hilton.
All right, this is the NASCAR podcast now.
Yeah, NASCAR. But I think it's neat. I mean, there's a lot of history here.
Yeah.
And I know none of it, so I'm incapable of saying anything.
We have the heart of NASCAR.
Apparently, I had no idea.
Well, now it's down in Charlotte now, which is why I avoid driving there if I can. But
so you have to end up in a race.
There was some sort of game event at NASCAR in Charlotte, and after I moved out here, I was invited to that, and I was like, thanks, but
you don't want to be anywhere near there. NASCAR days.
another of Sega's 3D games, the next one we'll talk about is Virtua Striker, which actually it's soccer, and therefore I'm also incapable of saying anything intelligent about this. But, you know, I feel like this at the time must have been sort of a revolutionary game also, because it is soccer, but now
3D.
It's 3D. The camera moves down into the field. The players have animations, and it's not just like little repetitive sprites moving around. There's, you know, there's immersion and there's action and the heat of things. I don't know. I'm assuming either. That people who play soccer and love soccer were like,
I know a little bit about
blows
soccer,
my mind.
But I don't really know this game, unfortunately, very well.
Yeah, I am not a big soccer/football video game fan, so I can't speak to it much. So we know nothing about it, but it's 3D and it's soccer. And maybe it was popular in Japan or Europe or something, you know.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how well. I mean, obviously the big soccer franchises are big there now. I don't know how well Virtua Striker went over.
And there's no way to know either, because we're locked in this room.
All right, so let's take a side detour onto a very strange little game that feels like it would be kind of an evolutionary dead end for Sega, but Nintendo would pick up the thread like a decade later and say, yeah. Hell yes. And that is Puzzle and Action, Tant-R, which was the first of the Puzzle and Action trilogy. But they're all kind of the same thing. But they're basically minigame collections. Weirdly enough, I had no idea until I was researching this episode. I've heard of Tant-R, but I didn't realize that it was a spinoff of Bonanza Brothers. But I looked at the visual graphics. Style, and immediately I was like, wow, that looks like Bonanza Brothers. Was it made by the same people? And so I looked it up, and it is, in fact, a spinoff of Bonanza Brothers, where the main characters are, like, instead of being thieves or whatever, now they are, like, doing
it's
an art
like
heist.
A detective.
They're actually detectives now. Yeah. They've had a heel face turn.
Yeah. Hmm.
And you're actually, like, trying to stop criminals. A jail gang, you know, and their stripes and everything. There's like five of them, and you're trying to stop them by playing competitive mini games.
They became that's part of their plea deal. They became snitches. And
I guess.
But yeah, turn state's evidence.
If you help me, we'll let you.
Weird
go.
Blobby Bonanza cartoony Brothers. Style that we saw in Bonanza Brothers that you don't really see anywhere else. And it's like this kind of Mad Magazine looking kind of low res aesthetic going on.
But this game is just like a visual hodgepodge. It is like
it's all over the place.
Stylistically, there is no coherence to it, but that's kind of the point, because it is, you know, it's basically WarioWare 10 years before WarioWare. So I wish I had known about this game a lot sooner, because it's pretty wild. And again, like, all the games are competitive. So it's not just that you're playing, you know, a micro game, you're playing a micro game against either another player or against the computer, and doing things like trying to inflate balloons. And I didn't even write down the stuff that you're doing.
It was like a rock, paper, scissors thing.
A maze and some sort of, just where you match puzzles.
Yeah, the most interesting
puzzles together.
Yeah, the most interesting one I saw was this kind of like geometry logic puzzle where it's like, if you take this shape and subtract this shape from it, what do you get? And you have to pick from these options. It's like kind of visual
that's
reasoning.
That's the
kind
of stuff they asked me on tests when I was a kid.
Yeah,
it's like the cat test.
It has that feel to it, that like general like ability to figure things out test kind of thing going on.
Skulch is junk. Yonker is a young man.
Yeah, oh God.
I don't get it. But, you know, this whole thing is obviously, I mean, the people who developed those tests played this game a lot. Puzzle and Action Tant-R.
Totally. Or vice versa. Maybe the people who developed this game were like, I got to get this cat system stuff out of my system. I gotta exercise it.
Does that guy who makes the Professor Layton puzzles figure into this somewhere?
Maybe. I don't know.
I have no idea.
But yeah, like this game apparently came to, I think, Saturn. But I don't think it came to the US. I don't think there was ever a home release in the US. I don't know if there was ever a home release in the arcades either. This might have been something that stayed stranded in Japan. So it's one of those things that
it's fun.
I've heard mentioned, like people talk about it sometimes, but I knew nothing about it until I actually sat down and said, I need to be able to talk about this game. So then I watched videos and read about it and was like, this is crazy and amazing. And there was something kind of similar on Sega CD called Switch, not to be mistaken for Double Switch, which was a completely different game for Sega CD. But Switch was called Panic in Japan, or maybe it was called Panic here and it was called Switch in Japan. I think the other way around. But that was also like a very sort of surreal, goofy micro game collection. So Sega was kind of dabbling in this for a while.
I like that there's so many obscure cult Sega games that no one's really heard of. You could just dig into this forever, and maybe that's what we're doing.
we are digging into this
podcast
forever.
Series about this.
Let me tell you about the rest of your eternity.
You could do a lot of episodes about Sega games. No.
Yeah, this was going to be our final Sega episode, but I can tell you, we've got at least three more here. Maybe two more. I don't know. But Sega just has an arcade legacy. They're crazy.
The chain is chafing my leg, Jeremy.
Try lotion. After that that little side diversion into goofy digitized photos and sprites and micro games, let's move back over to the Virtua series and talk about Virtua Cop, which is I'm thinking probably the second most popular Virtua game, or would that third? I mean, Fighter is definitely the most.
What about racing?
Racing's up there, racing, but. Yeah. But I feel like Virtua Cop lasted for quite a while, up into the Dreamcast era.
I was never a fan of the light gun
games, especially this one. Like, it's kind of, you know, it's just a pretty slow shooting gallery sort of deal. And again, you know, of course, back then, you know, having your shooting gallery in actual 3D was novel. Mm-hmm.
It allowed for dramatic camera pans. Like, this game did a lot of the things Alien 3 the Gun tried to do, like, you know, give you these environments that you're moving through very immersively, and give you this kind of cinematic viewpoint, but it did it in such a, like, in a more measured and enjoyable way. Maybe too measured. Like, I can see where you could complain that this game is way too slow paced, but I think that's okay. It is more of like the classic, you know, police simulator, because it's Virtua Cop. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you have enemies that you have to shoot, and then you have civilians that you have to avoid shooting.
It's Hogan's Alley.
Kind of, yeah. Very similar. But instead of just being cardboard cutouts, they're running around and making, you know, like escaping from banks and driving around on vehicles. And
there's this targeting reticle thing. Reticle. That's so iconic about this game. I think they featured it in the advertising, even this you know, the bright circle with the triangles and stuff, and it zooms in and it changes, and that's what I remember the most about this game.
Yeah, basically the idea behind the reticle is that each enemy is kind of like, when they appear on screen, a reticle appears around them, and it starts out blue, like a big blue circle, and it zooms in closer to them, and it turns green, and then yellow, and then red. And once it turns red, they fire at you. So you have until the color changes to take them out. And if you don't take them out in time, then they shoot at you, and you lose a life. So it's kind of like what Time Crisis would do. But I can't play this game after playing Time Crisis. Time Crisis I actually played first. So Virtua Cop has always seemed very sort of dated to me. And, you know, the Sega Namco rivalry, I've always felt is actually a much more turbulent rivalry than the Sega Nintendo rivalry.
Well, in arcades, definitely.
Yeah, like those were the two big giants, and they were always doing the same kind of thing: Virtua Fighter Tekken, Rolling Thunder Shinobi, and then Virtua Fighter Time Crisis. But in this case, I really feel like Time Crisis, especially starting with 2, just does a much better job of it. And the thing that Time Crisis adds is there's the time element, sure, like that's the gimmick, but the real element that it adds is the ability to duck behind scenery. So it's a cover-based shooter. So it creates this extra element of skill and planning. Like, is it good to duck out now and take a shot at an enemy, or should you hide behind cover? Like, if you hide behind cover too long, then you run out of time. So there's this real tension to it that is lacking in Virtua Cop.
More of a back and forth between you and the enemies, as opposed to Virtua Cop, where it's just, well, these guys are kind of slow to start shooting at you.
Sounds like a crisis to me.
Well, I would say Virtua Cop is okay, but not my favorite.
They were definitely both presences in arcades for a long time. You would have the Virtua Cop series and the Time Crisis series, most big arcades, and you would probably have both of them.
But the cool people have always played Time Crisis. Still, Virtua Cop was way, way better than the next game, which is Jurassic Park, which is very much along the lines of Alien 3 the Gun.
Yeah.
It's just hyperactive, super scalar, dinosaurs everywhere.
It looks terrible.
It's ridiculous.
It's in the very hyperactive light gun mold where it's just throwing a million things at you a second, and it really makes no sense with this license. Like, you've got this herd of 50 triceratops that you're blowing away with a machine gun as they charge at you. Like, it's
right, because that's so true to the movie. Oh, you know? Stupid. Oh, the dinosaurs that we have created have gone wild. Let's murder them all.
Yeah.
That's not really what the preservationist scientists were going for, but okay. I will say that they revisited Jurassic Park a few years later for The Lost World, and that version, that sequel, holds up a lot better and is a lot more fun. It's less hyperactive and sort of like just, you know, what's happening here. It had a great sit-down cabinet that was kind of like a, you know, like a Jeep that you would drive through the jungle in. Mm-hmm. And I don't know.
I played that.
Yeah, it was a lot better. Yeah, it was really
good. I remember seeing that one.
Cool.
And not this one, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah, this one, like, I never saw this in arcades, but man, I would not want to play this like a game.
No, it looks terrible.
Virtua Cop is definitely like the way to go. More measured, more sensible. Everything has impact and meaning. Like, each enemy you have to take on seems carefully staged and thoughtful, as opposed to just like, have some sprites in your face.
Dinosaurs are cool, but just
annoying. It should have been just a bunch of Jeff Goldblums rushing at you and you get to shoot them.
Watch the gun, please.
That's a good one.
Oh, so a different kind of Virtua.
Yes. Next up, not Virtua, Virtual.
Virtual.
Cyber Troopers Virtual On.
Batron.
I admit I've never played this game, but I know lots of people who love this game. Yeah. It's not really my kind of game. But it looks really cool, and
this was a big cult thing, especially in Japan. Like, not a lot of it made it over here. It was very rare over here, but it was huge in Japan. So it's a 3D arena fighter, essentially. So you have these big environments you're running around, and you're in mecha, is the hook. So you have these 3D mecha, and it's got this really unusual control scheme. You've got two joysticks. So it's kind of this tank scheme where you can go both forward, both back to move in a direction, or you can go one forward, one back to spin quick. But then there's extra things tacked onto the control scheme, like moving both joysticks out does a special thing. Moving them both in does a special thing. You can jump and dash. And then there's a lot of ranged weaponry, and you can also do close-in attacks. And it was really the first 3D mecha combat game to take off. Not surprisingly, people were really excited about this in Japan, where mecha had been a thing for a long time. It had a huge following there, got some sequels, it was one of the very few games that got ported to Saturn and that supported their network system for Saturn.
Saturn
had an online network system. I'm sure it was incredibly clunky, as everything was back at that time.
Sure, why not?
But you could do versus Virtual On over the network.
I wanted that so bad. Are you talking about the net, what's that called? Net modem thing for the Saturn?
When it came out in America,
you could play Duke Nukem 3D over it or something. I have one.
Did you have to use Dwingo?
I don't know. I don't remember. I didn't get a chance to play it when it was active, but I bought the modem later. I did play games on X-Band on the Super Nintendo, which is a whole... We should do a micro on that, because that was crazy.
I was just thinking, we could do a full episode on online gaming technology for consoles and PCs. It took a while for it to get good.
I've got a lot of experience with that, so it'd be fun to talk about. But this game, I've never played Virtual On. I've heard people talk about it, but it's just too foreign.
Yeah, I was going to say too Japanese.
Too Japanese.
It is very much like,
even
this is very 90s Japan.
It's
anime.
Very 90s Japan. It's
like, if you were a big fan of Gundam or Evangelion, maybe not Evangelion.
But it does. It has really Mazinger nice character G. designs. It doesn't. It doesn't license anything. It doesn't even riff too closely, I think, off any particular things. It really goes its own direction. But it has this very colorful cast. It looks like a fighting game cast. You've got larger guys and smaller guys, more agile guys, and all that kind of thing. But they're all very colorful and kind of have a lot of personality for a robot.
Well, and you know, it does
for
the arena
a robot.
Some robots are very dry. Yeah, like it really plays up the arena thing. This is one of the first arena fighters, if not the first, give you like a 3D space to fight in. So you're not just fighting against another robot. You're also making use of the environment and, you know, putting buildings between the two of you and construction cranes and crates and things like that.
You've got a lot of maneuverability. Yeah. There's like there's dash moves that you can do. And so, it's there's a lot of positioning and tactics kind of in it.
Wow. Yeah, you would see this idea played up a lot more over the, you know, like the next 5 or 6 years in games like Air Geist, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Power Stone was a big one from Capcom. There was also, was it called Versus? VS? There were a couple, maybe Gekido. I can't remember. I know there are a couple of PlayStation fighting games that try to do this very badly.
That's my least favorite genre, arena fighters, so I know nothing about it.
Well, Power Stone was good.
I played Power Stone. I mean, that was like Dreamcast. Great.
Mm-hmm. One of the big successes of this today is there's a Gundam Versus series, which again is big in Japan and occasionally comes out over here. I think there's a new one that's supposed to be coming out in the US on PS4.
Probably. I kind of don't keep track of Gundam, but
Cat would know. Can we call Cat? Cat would know when it's coming out. We should phone a friend. But they are very much the same idea that started back here with Virtual One, in that you've got these big arenas and a lot of maneuverability, a lot of long range attack options, that sort of thing.
I'm actually kind of tempted to crack up my phone and call Cat Bailey right now. Be like, hey, we're on the recording of Retronauts. Is there,
when is Gundam Versus coming out? Let us know.
Let's not do that.
Patch him in.
Okay.
I'm sure. Like Cyber Troopers Virtual On, definitely one of the more interesting and memorable games of the era, even though this is not one that I've been into myself.
It was very rare to find it actually in the US in arcades. Like, I think there were a few, you know, probably in San Francisco.
Yeah, people who were really big into importing at the time, like James Milkey is a huge fan, because this was very much his jam right here. Like an import game.
I'm sure.
From Sega, very sort of niche and stylish and fun, colorful, and also competitive.
And you get
the people who were into that kind of thing, like, were really into this game.
Yeah, and so actually, I was in, I did a summer exchange program in Japan when I was in college. So this was back in the mid 90s. And one of the guys I went with, like, one of his holy grails when we went was he was going to play the hell out of Virtual On when he found some in some Japanese arcades, and I'm pretty sure he did. So.
And we never heard from him.
So we move on to two different motorcycle games, one that is very good and one that let's talk about the bad one first. Let's talk about Manx TT. No, just kidding. Let's talk about Cool Riders.
Cool Riders.
This game, I had never heard of it before, and reading about it, I can find no really good information about it. But watching videos about it makes me feel like I had been dropping acid without realizing it. It's bizarre.
It's got these weird digitized graphics, which people got in their head was a good thing every once in a while.
It's 2D sprites that are digitized. And
I feel like this is an attempt to compete with Road Rash. But instead of, you know, being like a competitive racing game, it's more like just a weird as hell racing game. It has all these strange digitized graphics that are just kind of thrown together. It's a very mishmash visual style and doesn't make any, like, it has no cohesion.
I found a review from Sega Pro Magazine, October 1995.
Does it give it like a 2 out of 10?
It says 46 out of whatever, but
that's pretty brutal.
The block quote thing is, scenery is made up of slabs of graphics which look awful. What do they call it?
You know, the pull quote. The pull quote is that it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
Someone tried and it didn't really come together.
I never played it. It looks fascinating there now. I want to play it.
It's fascinating, but I don't know if I
just fascinating.
It's good.
Like maybe you should drop acid and play it.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Would you ever?
It's the Cybermorph of Sega racing games.
Cybermorph's not that bad, dude.
No, never mind. That's the famous story about Game Fan, someone putting dropping acid into the company coffee pot, and the reviewer played Cybermorph and wrote this like detailed review about how you could like see the people in the little house as you flew past waving at you. And it's pretty crazy. It's great stuff.
That's funny.
Check that out sometime. Yeah. Cybermorph Acid.
Okay, I will.
It's worth a read.
So the question is, why would you play this when in the same year from the same company we also had Manx TT?
Manx TT. So the one thing that Cool Riders did was combine some weird as hell motorcycle racing with the Outrun structure. It has the branching paths. That's about it. Manx TT, on the other hand, really feels like, or at least looks like, the sort of Virtua version of Hang On.
Yeah.
It's like a very fast-paced, energetic motorcycle game. And it gives you a first-person perspective and really plays up the advent of polygonal graphics by sort of embodying the lean element of racing, of bike racing. So the horizon is constantly like rotating back and forth. You know, if you play Super Hang On, like if you play the 3DS version of it with the simulated arcade cabinet, you get that same effect where it's like tilting back and forth, pitching as you lean into a turn. Mm-hmm. Well, this does that already, even without a cabinet or without a sit down cabinet, by giving you this rotating horizon, which you can do very easily in polygons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it gives you this really impressive sense of speed and that immersion that you want in a racing game. It's I admit I have not played the game, but just watching it, I'm like, man, this game would be so cool to play on a big screen, you know, like a 30-inch monitor and an arcade, especially with a sit-down cabinet. But even the stand-up would be incredible.
Yeah, and the sit-down has the motorcycles you actually sit on and lean into. I think I saw pictures of it. But, someday there's going to be an awesome Sega arcade that has every one of these, and we can just go there and play them.
And it's really like, it's more like Daytona in that you've got all these lush textured everything and bright colors, and it's another one of those sort of blue sky looks really pretty.
I'd heard of Manx TT but didn't realize until researching for this episode that it's another Sega racing game. But yeah, looking at it, it's such a Sega game. I mean, it really does feel like, why didn't they not call this Hang On 3D? Like it's such a descendant of Hang On.
Yeah, it's named after like the super bike or something that you're riding on, I'm pretty sure. But,
so at this point, we get to like 94, 95, and we start to see actual sequels to some of Sega's big 90s games. There's Virtua Fighter 2, Virtua Cop 2, and then Sega Rally Championship, which isn't really a sequel, but does feel kind of like the next Sega racing game. Mm-hmm. So Virtua Fighter 2 is, you know, like as with so many fighting games, it is a refinement of what came before. It looks nicer. It, you know, has a little more developed play mechanics. It has like two new characters, and then it has the final boss Dural, who would be kind of like a key figure in the company's internal legacy. That was the original code name for one of the models of Dreamcast. There was the Katana and the Dural. The Dural was named for the final boss of Virtua Fighter 2, who was like this shiny metallic reflective like a female body form. Without a face or a personality, but she could mimic any character's moves. So fighting her, like, you never knew what style you're going to have to face because she could use any character's skill set.
Which, again, can you tell the Tekken 1 and 2 guy was involved here? Yeah.
Is that a Tekken thing? I don't really follow Tekken.
Yeah, there's a character in most of the Tekken games that can do that.
It's like the queen piece in chess. Anything you want.
Except the queen piece cannot move like a knight.
Yeah, it can't move like a knight. I just thought of that, too. I take that back.
But also they were probably showing off, you I'm know, ashamed. All their
it's okay.
Their new textures and stuff. So again, it had, you know, it had everything textured, which got backported to the original Virtual Fighter 2.
You can't do the en passant.
Damn.
And I'm sure the shiny final boss was again showing off, you know, some new texturing technique that they developed. So
oh yeah, like metallic reflections.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That was everyone wanted to do that. Remember how there was a power up in Super Mario 64?
Yeah,
that metal, was literally just like Mario turns into metal and everything's reflective for 30 seconds and then it stops.
Yep.
Yeah. Like everyone was like, ah, check out this cool effect we can do. It's so crazy.
Yep.
And of course, now that we actually know how, hey, we've seen more like ray casting and actual reflections and transparencies in games, we look back and we're like, oh, this is just a lot of fakery. Like you look at Dural, you look at Metal Mario, you're like, meh. But it sure seemed cool at the time.
Yeah. It's like the blinking tag in HTML. It's exciting when it first came out.
Oh, God, I forgot about that. Why did you bring that back? Stop.
Blink.
Oh,
blink.
No. Blink. Not the blink tag. All right, so also there's Virtua Cop 2, which is more of the same, but the environments are a little different. It's more like an urban setting, more enclosed spaces. It's a pretty interesting game, but it is still like Virtua Cop, so therefore not as good as Time Crisis. And definitely not as good as Time Crisis 2, which, let's be frank, is an amazing game. It's awesome. Thank you. And finally, Sega Rally Championship, which is, again, like the third of these 3D Sega racing games. And this is more of the sort of Outrun style game, as opposed to, you know, racing around a track. You know, it is a rally championship, so it's kind of based on like the Paris-Dakar rally or something along those lines, where you are going from one place to another. You have
That's crazy.
Oh, well, as
you
opposed
go from one place to another,
as opposed to a track-based game where you're driving in a circle.
Well, you're still going from one place to another. The other side of the track.
You're going from one place to the same place. You're literally driving to the same spot.
You got a lot of scenery in this game.
Yes.
Yeah.
Scenery.
So I remember this.
There's three tracks and three cars. Yeah. This game is kind of cool. Notable because it was the first game designed by Tetsuya Mizuguchi, who you don't really associate with racing games at this point. You're like, there's no like trippy, weird techno music in this game. But everyone's got to start somewhere.
Yep. Yeah, I was talking to Jeremy earlier. One of the things you find researching a lot of these old games is that everyone who today we think of as this auteur who has like this thing they do, most of these guys just started out, you know, as work for hire somewhere working on Sega. whatever needed doing. A lot of them at Sega, yeah. And, you know, it took a while before these guys found the thing they do really well and have a unique take on. And then, you know, once that's established, the company's like, okay, yeah, you go do that.
Yeah. Hideo Kojima designed a game about a penguin running through Antarctica first.
Yeah.
I can't remember what all he did. It was like super mundane.
For a thing on my log, I just discovered that Iga, the Castlevania guy, started out doing programming on Tokimeki Memorial, the dating sim.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And
all of them did a Super Hang-On clone. Every single one of them.
at some point in their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see who else. Goichi Suda wrote character profiles and story endings for Fire Pro Wrestling, which actually that seems like, okay,
yeah, that actually,
yeah,
that
like,
makes
okay,
sense.
That makes sense. Yeah. I got that. But yeah, it's always fun to kind of see where these guys started when they've started to develop their own personalities and their own sort of game aesthetics. And I don't know, like seeing Tetsuya Mizuguchi's name on a game like Sega Rally Championship. And you can go back a few months ago. I did an interview with Mizuguchi, which is now a podcast. You can listen to that, and he'll talk more about how he got a start in Sega. But seeing his name on a racing game is kind of like, I don't know, like if Yoko Taro, the guy who makes Nier, like started out doing, you know, like mascot platformers or something.
Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, exactly. it's just kind of like, huh, okay, sure. Everyone's got to, you know, get their foot in the door, I guess.
Although, I don't know, Rez, you're still here. You're moving down a corridor. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. to the final segment of this episode. There's still a lot of Sega to talk about. but we'll talk about like just two or three more games.
More fighting spin-offs.
Fighting Vipers. This was, I would say, like their attempt to kind of do 3D and also give it personality like King of Fighters or Street Fighter. To kind of, you know, create an interesting cast of characters with more outlandish moves.
Yeah, less realism.
Right. Yeah, like it's Virtua Fighter, you have like, you know, the craziest thing you have is like the Drunken Master, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas Fighting Vipers is way more outlandish. I believe there's a Daytona car as an unlockable.
Oh, was that in this game?
Oh, I remember
I think
that.
It was this one. Yeah. Wasn't it this one?
It was on one of those games. I remember seeing it in a magazine.
The Japanese release had Pepsi Man as a guest character. You didn't make it over to the US release.
I feel like this was the one where you could unlock the Daytona car and it would like hop around on its back tires and punch you with its front tires.
Which is, you know, that's sort of my relationship with cars.
Just them hopping up and punching you in the face?
Yeah.
But this introduced a few new things. So it had... the stages had walls, unlike the early 3D stuff, which was just sort of this platform floating in space. Now you had walls and you could like bounce characters off it or knock them through it with a finishing move and that sort of thing. So that was kind of cool and something that got picked up by some later 3D fighters. And then it also had this armor mechanic, which didn't really get used much after that. But the characters
was that
had,
this? I thought that was Last Bronx. Okay.
Yeah, this one had armor. There was regularly you could break a character's armor with certain moves and then they would take more damage after that.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. And there were a few characters from Fighting Vipers who kind of transcended the game. I think, Honey?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a couple of characters who were sort of...
Daytona car.
Yeah, the Daytona car definitely went on
to... He went on to star in a racing game.
Yeah, game over. Yes. Well, no, I've lost my train of thought. Way to go, Binge.
Well,
you're welcome. That's why I'm here, man.
Then it had the Sonic spinoff.
Yes, there was Sonic the Fighters,
which evidently was originally like internally a joke mod to Fighting Vipers. So it's pretty much the same engine. You know, some Sega, I didn't get a name of who it was, but some Sega engineer, you know, wrote Sonic into this engine, and they said, "Sure, do that as a game." So there's a whole game that's Sonic 1-on-1 3D fighting with Sonic characters, and it's pretty much the same mechanics as Fighting Vipers. They've got the armor changed into like usable barriers, so your block move put up barriers and you had a limited supply of them, but you could also like trade them off for special attacks, which was kind of an interesting mechanic. But beyond that, it was pretty much just a mascot fighter.
It was the mascot fighter until Smash Brothers came along.
That's true. There wasn't really anything else in this.
I can't think of anything that would have been comparable. Tournament fighters, I guess.
Yeah.
In 2D.
But this felt special because it was Sonic, you know. It was Sega's mascot doing this thing.
Yeah, and it was kind of weird for the time. Like, and, you know, now Sonic's in absolutely anything and everything. But back then, you know, Sonic was the platformer. Yeah. What's it doing in this 3D fighting game? That's kind of strange.
Turtles already fought people with weapons. Yeah. So Sonic was more of a strange juxtaposition of battling.
You do knock rings out of your opponent, though, just so you know it's still Sonic, I guess.
All right, and then there was Sega's maybe their first ever Christmas game, Die Hard Arcade. So then there was Die Hard Arcade, which I haven't played, but I'm very familiar with this game. I've read a lot about it and seen like videos of it, and I always hear people talk about it. It was not actually a Die Hard game when it started. In Japan, it was called Dynamite Deca. And I don't know why it picked up the Die Hard license, but it totally worked. I guess they like, I think this was one of those cases where they made a game and were like, this game is going to be the video game equivalent of Die Hard. And then when it came to the US, Sega of America was like, this game should just be Die Hard. So they got the license for it and they added it. But I mean, it starts out with you infiltrating a skyscraper from the top level and working your way down. And like every setting in the game, like does seem like it came straight out of the original Die Hard, up to the fact that like when you infiltrate on the roof, you like go over the side. It just like the way it does it is so Die Hard. And you fight as, I guess, John McClane. Or Duke Deka, if you want to be. It's really interesting because if you watch through to the end of the game or play through to the end of the game, your outfit becomes more and more tattered and torn up as you play. Like every stage, there's new damage to your outfit. Just like, you know, John McClane was constantly getting bruised and bloodied, and just his outfit was all wrecked up by the end of the game or by the end of the movie. So you like start out with a police vest and camouflage pants, and by the end, you're in like a tattered wife beater and these torn pants that are like ripped up to your knees. And yeah, it's just like full of little details like that. It does some kind of weird stuff. Like every once in a while, there will be what amounts to quick time events where the game action suddenly shifts to a first person point of view and you like rush at enemies and you have to press certain button combos just right. And if you don't do them, then you like stumble and fall and the enemy gets to fight you. But if you do it right, then you like clothesline the bad guy and take them out of the action so you don't have to fight them. But it's mostly a brawler,
yeah,
with occasionally these weird sort of first person quick time event sequences put in. And then, you know, it does kind of go off the rails toward the end. Like you work your way down to the lobby of the Nakatomi building and then you somehow end up way back high fighting a robot. So it kind of like at the end, you're like, you guys just kind of ran out of ideas, huh? But and then like the final boss is this old man. I don't know if it's supposed to be Mr. Nakatomi or Nakajima or what was his name? Nakatomi? Oh, actually, no, Nakatomi wasn't his name. I can't remember what his name was. The elderly executive who gets shot by the bad guys. Hans Gruber. No?
I was going to say, I think that's probably when the Die Hard license ran out. The robot came in.
No, I'm pretty sure the next
stages and no
the Die Hard movies have gotten more and more ridiculous and off the rails. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure like the next Die Hard movie will invite robots.
Sure. Die Harder and Die Hardest.
We haven't gotten to Die Hardest yet, but I hope like that's the ultimate superlative. So that means the series will be over.
Oh no, like final.
But fantasy. Yeah, it definitely seems like in the original development it's like, so, okay, obviously they're applying the Virtua formula to, you know, what else can we apply it to? Let's do a brawler. And whoever made this was just fans of Die Hard. Probably. It seems extremely likely.
Yeah, pretty much. So I guess finally let's just do one last game, and that's Gunblade New York, which is kind of like Virtua Cop, but also kind of like Thunderblade. You don't have any, you're in a helicopter. You don't have really any control over where the helicopter goes, but it kind of turns it like you're sitting in the gunner seat, I guess, and fighting enemies
on rails, on the helicopters.
Yeah. Here. Yeah. So
it's the worst kind of helicopter.
It becomes sort of like a cinematic shooter where you get these really dramatic camera angles and the screen is constantly panning around. So it adds kind of like this sort of an immersive, visually impressive element, but also, it makes it a little more terrible. Unpredictable, challenging. No, not terrible. Do you actually know what you're talking about at this point?
No,
okay.
No.
Yeah. No, it makes it more challenging because, you know, the viewpoint is shifting.
Yeah. You got to sort of keep track of where the enemies are and
helicopter-y.
Ride is doing.
Mm-hmm. So
we can do the next one in 10 seconds. Too.
Okay. The next one. Go for
Virtua Fighter Kids. It's Virtua Fighter 2. Only everyone is chibis. Super deformed cartoon kid guys. And other than that, it's pretty much just Virtua Fighter.
Yeah, I don't know why they made this game.
I don't know. I saw someone, I like the reviews of it, basically said this would have been a great extra in Virtua Fighter 2, but instead it was released as a standalone, like $50 game for some reason.
Maybe they thought it would bring in younger players?
Maybe.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
I think that kind of is a footnote to the whole scheme.
Anyway, so that takes us through like 1994, 95. We got about halfway through the 90s.
Yep.
That's pretty good.
There's still a lot more Sega to cover. I really thought we could get through the entire 90s.
That's another solid episode.
He's
in
got
there.
Like 10 pages of 90s stuff here.
Yeah, and that's not even getting into the new millennium. You got to get stuff like, what's that guy called? Space Harriers. No, Planet Harriers. That game was great. I never got to play it, but it looked great. You could be like a nurse flying around with a giant syringe, blasting enemies with a syringe. That's weird. That's great. I love that.
Inoculate this.
Exactly. See, like, eventually, so much for the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah. Eventually we'll hit where it's no longer retro. What's the cutoff for that now?
That would be, by the time this comes out, 2008.
Oh, God.
I don't think we're going to go that far, though. Like, there's a point at which, I guess maybe when Sega kind of, like, dissolved into itself, maybe that's where we cut off. Yeah. But hopefully one more episode, and then we can move on to other arcade giants, because there's so many more to talk about. There's Namco, Data East, Taito, Capcom. Oh, gosh. Probably some Americans, Atari. Yeah. Like, there's a bunch of people making video games in the past. We can talk about them. we gotta get through Sega. We gotta finish paying tribute to them. All right. So thanks everyone for listening again to us discuss the history of Sega and the arcades. I know we keep doing this, but there's just so many games to cover. What can you say? They were legendary. They revolutionized the video games industry. So there's a lot to say. And we are going to say it, by God. Uh-huh. So check back in a few months. We'll have another one of these. And hopefully that will be the end of our Sega marathon, and we can move on to other topics. In the meantime, this has been another fine and dandy episode of Retronauts. I have been Jeremy Parrish. As usual, you can support Retronauts on Patreon if you want us to continue making podcasts. That's great. Check out patreon.com/retronauts. Or you can just listen to us for free. Find us on iTunes, on the Podcast One Network, on the Podcast One app. Go to retronauts.com, where we post not only podcasts, but also other things that are very important and very worth your time to read, because we're cool. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter as Retronauts. And you can follow me on Twitter as GameSpite. That's where I'll be. Why don't you guys pimp yourselves? Ben, we're going to go with you first this time.
Oh, no.
Out of order. Switch things out of order. Yep.
I'm so confused now. Okay. I'm on Twitter as Kirin with two N's. K-I-R-I-N-N is me there. And I also have a occasionally relevant to this podcast retro blog on Tumblr as kirinsretrocloset.tumblr.com. Only one N in Kirin there. Or I'm also on Kirin Blur at Tumblr if you want just my random crap instead of the retro stuff. That's where you can find me.
Yeah. And I'm Ben Edwards. I just started a new podcast to compete with Retronauts that will reign supreme in 2018. No, just kidding. It actually has no crossover whatsoever. It's called The Culture of Tech. You can listen to it at theCultureOfTech.com. First guest, Steve Wozniak. Second guest coming out tomorrow, I hope, is Richard Garriott of Ultima fame. And everything I know about podcasting, I learned from the master.
So
Ben Elgin. Just kidding.
So basically, you're hanging out in your podcast getting really drunk.
Yeah, it's fun. There's some stories already. That's going to be saved for Patreon's supporters. So,
see. Patreon. So if you want to hear about Benj getting drunk.
Yeah, patreon.com/BenjEdwards to support my work. Of course, I really recommend doing the Retronauts Patreon, because it's really cool to get the episodes commercial free. Anyway, thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Benj. I messed myself up. I went backwards, and now I'm backwards, confused about which one of you is which. It's terrible. It's okay. I mean, you both have names that start with Ben. You both have beards.
We look exactly the same.
White guys. Yeah. Such a confusing, monotonous world. Anyway, that has been it for this episode of Retronauts, and we're going away now, so goodbye. See you.